Okay, well, I'm happy at your interest in Chinese Trotskyism. China had, outside the Soviet Union, the biggest Trotskyist movement anywhere in the world. At one point, Trotsky saw the Chinese Trotskyist movement as the flower of his flock, and even determined at one point to learn Chinese so that he could study the works of Chen Duxiu and other Chinese Trotskyists. He never actually did that. A lot of people set out to learn Chinese and don't finish the job, and Trotsky was among them. Trotskyism, despite being so important and despite having recruited into its ranks many of the leading thinkers and intellectuals and labor organizers of the early Communist Party when it was established in 1931, was very little known in the West for many years and had little or no impact on the thinking and strategy of the Fourth International. And the reasons for this were legion. One was, of course, the language barrier, which prevented Western Trotskyists from reading the works and publications of their Chinese comrades. Another was the situation in China up to 1949, under the Kuomintang police state, and in the late 1930s and early 1940s under Japanese occupation. So it was impossible for the Chinese Trotskyists to contact their co-thinkers in the Fourth International in other countries, and even to contact among themselves and exchange ideas and elaborate policies collectively. That was not possible. Another reason, of course, was that for much of the time, in the years leading up to 1952 and certainly thereafter, the Chinese Trotskyists were more in prison than on the streets conducting political activities, and were therefore doubly unable to make contact with their comrades abroad. And there are other reasons as well. There were some small contacts achieved by Chinese Trotskyist seafarers who went to America and Britain and were able to make contact with Trotskyists who'd escaped the net put out by the communists in 1952 when they arrested the communists, Trotskyists. And these Chinese seafarers spread some of the writings that the Trotskyists had published, but most of it was in Chinese and therefore inaccessible. My own connection with Chinese Trotskyism, I joined the Communist Party in the early 1960s, and I was expelled in 1965 as a Trotskyist. So I've been a long-term member of Trotskyist organizations. But my own, I'm a sinologist. I work on China, and my main academic endeavor was in the field of the early history of the official Chinese Communist Party, about which I wrote several books, and more latterly as an anthropologist on the Chinese diaspora, which also is relevant to this question, of course, because of the ejection from China of Chinese Trotskyists, those who escaped the prison net, and their re-emplacement in Chinese communities outside China. So Trotskyism and the diaspora is a thing, and therefore my interest in the diaspora is not entirely divorced from my interest in the early Chinese Communist Party, and latterly, since 1975, in the Chinese Trotskyist movement. How did that come about? As I say, we knew very little about the Chinese Trotskyists. We were even unaware of their of whether or not they'd survived, whether they were in prison or whether they were dead. We knew that they'd been arrested and netted up in 1952, but whether they were still alive or not, we didn't know. There's another reason, by the way, why Chinese Trotskyism, insofar as it did survive and insofar as it did make its positions known and try to engage in debate with the rest of the Trotskyist movement, and that was because there was a Maoist interlude in world Trotskyism at some point in the 1960s, in the sense that guerrillaism, rural movements, and the Vietnam War and its revolutionary movement became a prime concern of the international Trotskyist movement. Of the and the Chinese Trotskyist movement seemed to have nothing to say there. They were all in prison. They had followed an urban strategy and so on. So that's another reason why they were neglected by their comrades overseas. In 1975, through Tariq Ali, I got into contact with Wang Fanxi, who was sent out from China in 1949 by his comrades, aware that they were soon to be put into jail by the Maoist regime. And he was sent abroad to act as their liaison officer and to liaise both with the Trotskyists inside China, insofar as that was possible, and with the international organization. Neither really succeeded because he was soon deported from his safe place in Hong Kong by the British colonial authorities. And he rotted away for many years in Macau, where he had very few possibilities to make wider contact and to achieve proper links. In 1975, however, through with the help of Tariq Ali, I brought Wang Fanxi out of Macau to Leeds in the UK. The situation in Macau at the time was very perilous for Wang because the Maoist influence in Macau was much stronger than in neighbouring Hong Kong. And the Portuguese colonial government had all but surrendered control of the colony to Maoist placemen representing the Beijing regime. And a plot was underway to spirit Wang out of Macau into the mainland where he could be silenced and jailed. And we got him out in time. He came to Leeds. And I began a new phase in my academic activity, which was perhaps closer to my heart than my earlier work, and that was on the history and politics of Chinese Trotskyism. We've been together with comrades in Hong Kong, like Lam Chi-Leung, Ao Lung-Yu, and others. We rescued from obscurity the Chinese Trotskyist legacy by publishing their writings. Lam Chi-Leung has published a huge archive of their writings in Hong Kong in Chinese, and me, by through my collaboration with Wang Fanxi, bringing out memoirs of Zhang Xiaolin, Wang Fanxi, Sun Liangshi, the last letters of Chen Duxiu, a book on the history of China's urban revolutionaries, as I called them, and more latterly, several weighty volumes of translations of writings by all sorts of Chinese Trotskyist activists, the first of which has come out. The comrade, I don't know her name, who just mentioned Prophets Unarmed, and others are to follow. So, strangely enough, the strand of Chinese Trotskyism that was least known and most neglected is now perhaps the best known and the least neglected as a result of our work, because I don't think that there is a section of Chinese Trotskyism outside of the Soviet one that is so well served by writings already out or in the pipeline. So we can be proud of that. What of Chinese Trotskyism? The title of this session is Chinese Trotskyism, 1931 to 1952. But in fact, it's interesting and necessary to look before 1931 and, of course, after 1952 to get a full picture of this movement. Chinese Trotskyism, strangely for a movement that is internationally renowned for being sort of fiercely ultra-left and violent and so on, Chinese Trotskyism is always associated with democracy. Why was this? Partly because its founder, Chen Ruxiu, who had also previously founded the Chinese Communist Party, was himself a child of the democratic movement, the first democratic movement of China in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And he kept democracy as his first love throughout his life and died swearing by it, even though he continued to maintain his affiliation to the Fourth International. In the Chinese Communist Party in the 1920s and the lead up to the break off of the Trotskyists, the struggle for a plurality of views and for dissident opinions was constant. And Chen Ruxiu, although he was silenced for much of that time, continued to espouse the cause of democracy within the Chinese Trotskyism. So Chinese Trotskyism was known for its attachment to democracy. Of course, in 1927, the official Chinese Communist Party was destroyed. Remnants of it fled into the hills and the Mao Zedong Judo and others. But its urban strongholds were shattered, and most of its remaining leaders ended up either dead or in prison in that period. The Trotskyist policy in the light of the destruction of the Chinese Communist movement was to resurrect it and reconstitute it by a struggle for democracy. Mao Zedong and Stalin's attitude was different. They denied that a defeat had ever happened in 1927, because if they had admitted that, that would have been to impugn the revolutionary farsightedness and integrity of Stalin, who had, mothered the movement that led to the Chinese Communist defeat in 1927. But the Chinese Trotskyists admitted a defeat had happened and realized that a movement to reintegrate the shattered pieces of the movement in the towns and in the countryside was necessary. And so they called for a constituent assembly. Constituent assembly is a familiar demand of revolutionaries throughout the world, starting with the German Social Democrats in the late 19th century. But Trotsky urged the Chinese Trotskyists in 1931 to use the slogan to reconstitute the movement, and they did that. But the second main feature of Chinese Trotskyism is that they were all in prison for most of the time their activities could have been most fruitful. When they were arguing the case in the early 1930s against what had happened in the Chinese Revolution and calling for a different approach, they got quite some echo within the official party. But then they were swept up by Chiang Kai-shek and put into jail for years and stayed in jail and were unable to push forward their campaign for a constituent assembly. The third main strand of Chinese Trotskyism was a commitment throughout to permanent revolution. The idea that the revolution cannot be cooped up into discrete stages, that the revolution was in constant movement, and that the democratic activities lead inexorably and quickly to proletarian revolution. That was the idea of the Chinese Trotskyists. So these are the three main strands of thinking of the Chinese Trotskyists in that period. What else is there to say about that? Another thing about the Chinese Trotskyists that's worth bearing in mind is that they were an urban party. They were almost exclusively based in the big cities, Shanghai, Guangzhou, Hong Kong, Tianjin, and Beijing, and so on. And were unable, unlike the official party, to spread their organization to the countryside. Why was this? Partly through strategy, because they believed that in the modern age, the emergence of an urban proletariat and a critical intelligentsia in the cities was the key to the future of the Chinese Revolution. They didn't want a rural-based peasant rebellion, because the China's had thousands of such rebellions in the 2,000 years of Chinese imperial history, and they'd never led anywhere. On the contrary, they'd led to the restoration of autocratic regimes, and the Chinese Trotskyists thought that a new way forward was necessary, and that was in the cities. The other thing was, of course, that most of the people who became Chinese Trotskyists out of the Chinese Communist Party were intellectuals. Mao Zedong was the child of a peasant family. Others who gathered around him were rougher sorts who had an army background or peasant background, who knew the villagers, who knew how to behave there, and who could be listened to, who could speak the languages, the dialects, and so on. The Chinese Trotskyists weren't such people. They were the sort of people who, in another age, would have shone in academic life, in literature, in poetry. They were a different sort of people, and they were unable to learn the language of the peasantry. Even those that went down into the villages were crushed between the millstones of the Kuomintang and the Japanese occupiers, and of course also by the Maoists sniping from the trenches in between those two powers. So the Chinese Trotskyists did a great service to the Chinese Revolution, even in jail, by translating — they were allowed to translate in some cases, even in jail — by translating the opus of Marxism into Chinese. If Marxism was introduced in its original form into China, it was through the Trotskyists and with the help of Wang Mengzhou, the owner of the Oriental Bookshop, which published dozens of Marxist classics, most of them translated into Chinese by people like Wang Fangxi, Zheng Xiaolin, and so on. So that was their role. In the war, the Chinese Trotskyists, who had always been fissiparious, they'd always been on the brink of splitting, finally split. Why were they always on it? Because small organizations of that sort that have suffered great defeats do split. The Chinese official Chinese Communist Party also split. Jiang Guotao split off from it. Wang Ming split off from Mao Zedong. The revolution movements do split. And the Chinese Trotskyist movement also split. They were formed in 1931 out of four different groups that came together only because of the weight of Trotsky, whose advice they took to unite without further delay. But they split. They began to split in the mid-1930s. A lot of people in the Chinese Trotskyist movement were very hostile to Cheng Jiushou, who became a leading Trotskyist thinker and activist in that period. Why? Because they blamed him as the leader of the Chinese Communist Party in 1927 to 1929. They blamed him for the defeat, which was in fact a defeat foisted on Cheng Jiushou by Stalin. Cheng Jiushou himself had opposed the policy of remaining within a close alliance with the Kuomintang, and it was the Kuomintang that turned against the Communist Party and destroyed it in 1927. But he didn't have the confidence to stand up for his ideas. Only later, after coming across the writings of Trotsky and being influenced by him, did he begin to stand up on this issue. But anyway, I digress. My point was that the Chinese Trotskyists were on the brink of splitting at several points, and eventually they split in 1941. And they split into a what was called a majority and a minority. Actually, the what was in a majority and what was in a minority changed again and again. So the terms are nonsense as such. But a majority under Peng Shuji, and a minority under Zheng Xiaolin and Wang Panqi. The basis for the split was the Peng Shuji's belief that as long as China continued to resist Japan, the resistance was a positive movement and should be unconditionally, or not unconditionally, but should be supported. And a minority, which said that of course the resistance should be supported, but as soon as the Americans entered the war, the Pacific War, Pearl Harbor, December 1941 and so on, at that point the resistance would no longer be progressive and it would be necessary to follow another strategy, not a strategy of opposing resistance, but of turning resistance into revolution. You know, Lenin had had this idea of revolutionary defeatism. But to call for revolutionary defeatism in China in the war of resistance would have been unpatriotic and suicidal. And the Chinese communists instead called for revolutionary victoryism, a sort of playful pun on Lenin's idea of defeatism. But in any case, it made no difference because they were holed up in Shanghai under Japanese rule and had very little influence. And as I said, where they did make excursions into the countryside, Wang Fanxi did, he tried to create a basis in the countryside with an armed force, but he was defeated. Why were they defeated? Because they didn't know about fighting and warfare. They were no good at it. But another reason, of course, was the Chinese Communist Party was so strong by that time. It was supported out of the coffers of Moscow and wherever the Chinese Trotskyists made an appearance, they were wiped out either by the Japanese or by the Kuomintang or by the Chinese Communists. That was their fate. What could they do? Very hard to imagine a strategy. Wang Fanxi later said we should have gone into the countryside anyway. But whether that would have succeeded or not is a question worth pondering. After the Japanese surrender in August 1945, the Chinese Trotskyists reformed as a minority and a majority, one under Peng Shuji, the other under Zheng Xiaolin and Wang Fanxi, and they went their separate ways. The issue of democracy was again quite salient in this Trotskyist movement after 1945. Peng Shuji, the leader of the majority, had earned his credentials in the Chinese Communist Party in 1925 by coming back to China from Moscow. In Moscow, he was the secretary of the Chinese branch of the of the Chinese Communist branch, Chinese Communist Party's branch, and he had a reputation for being a hardline dogmatic thinker who used his position in Moscow to gain kudos and glory for himself. He was very unpopular with many of the Chinese Trotskyists who came out of the other stream, which was those young communists who'd gone to Moscow in 1927 and stayed there until 1931, who had witnessed the defeat of the revolution in China, and who became, because of having witnessed the defeat of the revolution in China, became critics of the Stalinist system. And so they came up into the Trotskyist movement as a critical force. But Peng Shuqi believed that he was, on a par with Chen Luxiu, that he would become a leader of the Chinese Communist Party. And after his expulsion from the Chinese Communist Party in 1929, he saw himself as the leader who would oust Chen Luxiu from the Chinese Trotskyist Party. So he had an authoritarian touch. He said we need a Leninist party, and we don't want factions in our movement. This was his idea in the early 1940s. Whereas the other strand of Chinese Trotskyists, the so-called minority under Wang Fangxi and Jiang Qianlin, called for a more democratic and less authoritarian approach. On other issues, they pursued a more or less similar policy. They continued to cheer on the movement for a constituent assembly, which got them nowhere. They continued their translation into Chinese of the Marxist classics, which was a heroic endeavor. And they tried to revive the labor movement, but achieve very little success in that respect. And then in 1952, of course, after the Chinese communists won the revolution in 1949. The Chinese Trotskyists looked on from the sideline. In 1948, the Peng Shuqi group formed its new party, the Revolutionary Communist Party, which was, sort of billed as the leader of the future Chinese revolution. In 1949, the Chinese Trotskyist minority formed their Internationalist Workers' Party, which was similarly, seen as a way forward for the new leadership of the revolution. But both were swept aside because they had been blind to the events in the villages. A lot of people were. I mean, a lot of people were surprised by the victory of the Chinese Communist Party. The Americans were, the British were, Chiang Kai-shek was, a lot of people were, but so were the Trotskyists. And they were unprepared. As I said, Wang Fangxi was sent abroad. Peng Shuqi and his group, most of the leaders left. And what was left behind in China was the rank and file of Peng Shuqi's minority group. So the rank and file of Peng Shuqi's minority group and the bulk of the leadership of Wang Fangxi and Jiang Qialin's minority group, the Internationalist Communist Party, were swept up into jail and stayed there for the next 27 years, many of them. People called Auguste Blanqui l'enfermé, the longest serving political prisoner in order. He wasn't. The Chinese Trotskyists were. Jiang Qialin spent 34 years in prison altogether. August Blanqui spent 33. I mean, I'm joking in a way, but that was their fate. In Hong Kong, the remnants of the Trotskyist movement went silent for a while after 1952. Wang Fangxi in Macau wrote his memoirs, which were actually a retrospective analysis of the reasons for the success of the Chinese Communist Party and the failure of the Chinese Trotskyist movement. And the chapter in which this issue figured most prominently was at first excised from the Oxford University Press edition of Wang's memoirs in translation, but it was reinstated in the Columbia University Press edition of the memoirs, if you want to read it, published in 1993, and which I put in Prophets Unarmed as well. So John Charlie was in jail. Pang Xiuzhu was in the US, where he was sort of feted as the great leader of the Chinese Revolution, and did very little really to acquaint the world Trotskyist movement, the real reasons for the success of the Chinese Revolution, because he was unable to grant agency, authority, achievement to his old enemies in the Maoist part of the Chinese Communist Party. Unlike Wang Fanxi, who was, if you read his book on Mao Zedong, which I published recently in the Brilliant Historical Materialism series, was much more generous in his assessment of Mao Zedong and much more appreciative of the Chinese mainstream communists' achievements. How long have we had? How long have we been talking for? Chair?
We're coming.
how long have I been talking for?
Another 10 minutes, it should be right. And then we'll open for discussion, and I'll give you a bit of time to respond towards the end.
Yeah. Okay, good. Right. Well, in Hong Kong, the movement became dormant. Because Pang Xiuzhu was in America by that time, Wang Fanxi was in Macau, and John Charlie was in jail. But in the late 1960s and the early 1970s, the Cultural Revolution in China, which was a complex movement, it was, we all know now that not the sort of movement that we can identify with. That it was cruel and violent and factional did not lead to socialist democracy and workers' revolution, as many of the Red Guards engaged in the Cultural Revolution believed that it would. It didn't do any of that, but it did create a worldwide movement, not just in China, but in Paris, Berlin, London, New York, and so on, and also in Hong Kong, of young people who were sort of anarchist in the Hong Kong case, and also in Paris, Berlin, and London, anarchistically inclined against authority. And in Hong Kong, this anarchistic movement born of the Cultural Revolution mutated in the early 1970s into a Trotskyist-tinged movement, which had various achievements to its name, minimal, but nevertheless some achievements. It set up a movement for a constituent assembly in Hong Kong, which was a good idea because the colony was in the hands of the British, their legislative council, which was in no way democratic, and a lot of dissident voices in Hong Kong were calling for democratic change. So the Trotskyists espoused this. And of course, they also carried on with their campaign for minimum wage to try to ally the movement for democracy with the movement for the pursuit of proletarian interests. This movement, on the whole, got nowhere. One of their main objectives was to marry the movement in Hong Kong with the incipient democratic movement that emerged out of the Cultural Revolution in China, in Beijing, in Guangzhou, and other places in China. And the establishment Democrats in Hong Kong were against this idea. They were afraid that they would bring down the wrath of China on their heads, and you shouldn't meddle with things that are not your concern. Let's get Hong Kong to rights, and don't try to change things in China. Of course, the recent events have shown that was a very short-sighted policy, that you can't have change in Hong Kong without change in China. And moreover, change in China can, if we're lucky, be influenced by change in Hong Kong. I wrote a book in 1983 in which I said that Hong Kong means fragrant harbour in Chinese, and everybody used to call it stinking harbour in order to, denigrate the Brits and the colony and so on. And I said in this book, I said that the democratic movement in Hong Kong will at some point, its fragrance will, I forget what I said, but its fragrance will pass over into the mainland and lead to changes there too. People laughed at it at the time. I don't think they're laughing now, because what's happening in Hong Kong has, to a certain, very limited extent, but nevertheless to an extent, influenced some of the thinking in China. Other areas in which the Chinese Trotskyists tried to reestablish themselves after 1952 was in the diaspora. You know, by the diaspora, I don't mean exiles like Wang Fengxi and Peng Shuizhu and people. I mean young Chinese who, born abroad of immigrant parents, either business people or more commonly so-called coolies, in places like Indonesia and Malaysia and also in North America, where also, again, because of the influence of the communists, Chinese communists' Cultural Revolution, revolutionary movements grew up. You had Black Power in America. You also had Yellow Power. And in this diaspora, especially now in North America, movements grew up that were influenced by Trotskyism and even that identify with Trotskyism. The same happened in Britain. When Wang Fengxi came to Leeds, he got into contact with comrades like Jervis Lam and Bobby Chan and so on in Chinatown in London, and they set up a newspaper and a group, and they waged struggles on behalf of restaurant workers and so on. But their main purpose was to send people back to Hong Kong. Wang Fengxi's idea was, Hong Kong is the site of our struggle as Chinese Trotskyists. They've got to go back there. But now that's no longer the case. Now, that was a movement of exile, but now it's a movement of diaspora, of people, of Chinese, ethnic Chinese people identification with the Trotskyists is not that of exiles, but of people, who can see the purpose in their own everyday lives of this movement. Well, I'll leave it at that, and I'm sure you have lots of criticisms and questions that you want to make, and I welcome.